je hebt dat wel. Je bent verstandiger dan ik dacht, vreemdeling.
Oh, wij bommels.
Ничего
не пишите.
Пишите.
Ничего не читайте.
Читайте.
Ничего не говорите.
Говорите.
Ничего
не печатайте.
Ach wat, mijn eigen tong was zwart, als u begrijpt wat ik bedoel.
Daarop begaf hij zich snel achter Tom Poes aan, die bezig was de fles het bos uit te rollen.
Wat ben je van plan? Wat wil je met die mondspoeling?
Daar is het nu de tijd voor. Nu gaan ze dopdroesem drinken.
Ja, ja. En daarna maken ze hem zwart. Ik weet het. Het is een vreselijke toestand.
Daarom moet u de leiding weer nemen. Ga naar het dorp, heer Bommel, en laat ze nog één keer met die wagen rondrijden. Als afschrikwekkend voorbeeld, zegt u maar.
Aha, een list. Laat dit aan mij over, jonge vriend. Het komt in orde.
Hij snelde de heuvel af, stak de heide over en bereikte in korte tijd de herberg. Daar maakten de dorpelingen zich juist gereed om Abel uit de wagen te tillen, doch de onverwachte komst van de vreemdeling stak hier een stokje voor.
Halt! Wat is dat? Deze deugniet moet minstens nog eens worden rondgereden, vrienden. Als list, als afschrikwekkend voorbeeld. Als iemand begrijpt wat ik bedoel.
Na enig beraad besloot de kudde met algemene stemmen om aan dit verzoek te voldoen. Men greep opnieuw de touwen en onder leiding van heer Bommel werd de wagen opnieuw door het dorp getrokken. Het was een allerakelig schouwspel, maar hij hield moedig vol. En daardoor kreeg Tom Poes de gelegenheid om de inhoud van zijn mandfles ongezien in het vat van de herbergier te storten. Zodoende vermengde de dopdroesem zich met het aftreksel van puimkruid en dat gaf een merkwaardige drank.
Wat schuimt die dop van de haar. Gisting ben ik. Maar dat verhoogt de rechtschapenwaakzaamheid, zeg ik altijd maar.
De dorpelingen hadden hun tocht inmiddels beëindigd. Ze hielpen Amram met het ontladen van de zwartseltobbe en daarop betraden ze met vastberaden gezichten de resten van de herberg.
Hier is de drank, heren. Tast toe, er is genoeg. Ja. Nee, tast u maar toe. Ja.
We drinken niet voor ons plezier.
Plezier trekt kwade krachten aan.
We drinken om krachten op te doen. De taak van de wrekende is zwaar. Vooral wanneer zijn eigen zoon de afvallige is.
Houd je maar goed, hier zit een list achter. Wacht maar tot ze gedronken hebben.
De drank is bitter. Dat zal het voor mij niet mooier maken. En zo is het maar net.
Het doet mij meer verdriet dan u. Maar ik ken mijn plicht. Je zult het boze oog krijgen, Abel. Je zult een vluchteling worden voor het aangezicht van de onberouwelijken. Geef me een glas droesem, moeder.
Ach, vader, moet dit nu?
Zwijg, vrouw.
Abeltje heeft het zo niet bedoeld.
Wie met zwarten omgaat, zal zelf zwart worden.
Hij zette het glas aan de schrale lippen en volgde het voorbeeld van zijn drinkende dorpsgenoten. Heer Olly, die gespannen toekeek, merkte op dat de drinkers al slikkend van kleur verschoten. Ze ledigden hun glas, keken bevangen van Abel naar diens vader, schuifelden met hun voeten en begonnen toen stilletjes te vertrekken. Onder het mompelen van een korte groet.
Hé, broeders! Wacht! Kom maar af, Abel! We gaan naar huis!
Maar de zwartseltobbe dan?
Ik wil er niets meer van horen. Praten over zwart en zwartsel roept alleen kwade krachten op. Ik wil er niets meer van horen. En voor de deugdzame is iedereen gelijk.
Zo is het maar net. En, Ola?
Ola is een aardig schaap. Niet helemaal een ooikooise natuurlijk. Maar ze kan nog veel leren.
Op dat moment ontmoette het tweetal Tom Poes, die met Moen onderweg was naar de herberg.
Ik kijk je aan. Met twee boze ogen.
Daar heb je alle reden toe. Maar ik zal u helpen met het opbouwen van uw huis, buurman. Misschien zal je je boosheid dan gaan vergeten.
Hij groette opgeruimd en vervolgde met zijn zoon de wandeling naar huis, waarheen de moeder hen reeds was voorgegaan.
Dat is sterk. Het lijkt er alsof hij alles over het boze oog vergeten is.
Zo lijkt het. Zijn zwarte tong is schoongespoeld. Maar ik ben het boze oog niet vergeten, jonge poes. Wanneer men eenmaal is zwart gemaakt, vergeet men niet zo gemakkelijk.
Die avond gaf heer Bommel een feestmaal in de herberg om de goede afloop te vieren.
Moet nog wennen. De schuld drukt zwaar.
Wie praat hier over schuld? Schuld trekt kwade krachten aan.
Zo is men net. De rechtvaardige moet nederig en zonder schuld zien stille weggaan. Want het boze loert.
Laten we nu niet langer over kwade krachten spreken. Die bestaan niet.
Bestaan die niet?
Wel, nee. De oorzaak van alle ellende in deze buurt waren jullie eigen zwarte tongen. Maar door een list heb ik... Ik bedoel, we hebben puinkruid door jullie drank gemengd. En daardoor...
Hij zweeg. Want het viel hem op dat de stilte wat drukkend werd. Daarom stopte hij haastig zijn pijp en stak de brand erin.
Een rechtschapen heer hoeft niet nederig over de weg te gaan. Als hij maar zorgt dat zijn tong schoon is. Als iemand begrijpt wat ik bedoel.
Tabak! Het roken van tabak trekt kwade krachten aan.
Zo is het maar net. En het zijn de vreemdelingen die schuldige smook en nieuwe wetsigheid in onze mooie oude gebruiken brengen.
Vreemdelingen hebben dikwijls het boze oog. Kijk maar wat er met mijn uitspanning gebeurd is.
Het boze loert altijd. Vreemden komen met hun schuld en hun kunsten in deze treffelijke streken. En zij lokken de rechtschapenen van het rechte pad af.
Heer Bommel stond verontwaardigd op. Hij wilde iets zeggen, maar Tom Poes trok hem snel naar buiten.
Hierheen, daar staat je auto. Je motorkap is nog steeds gerimpeld, maar ik kan rijden. Verdwijn nu maar vlug.
Dit is meer dan een Bommel verdragen kan. Door ons is de strijd tussen de zwarte en de witte bijgelegd. En nu word ik van mijn eigen feestmaal weggejaagd.
Zo is het leven. Mensen altijd iemand zoeken om zwart te maken. Puinkruid helpt maar voor een korte tijd. En wanneer de tong weer duister wordt, brengt hij onheil over hem die anders is. Ik voor mij heb liever dat men zich tegen vreemdelingen keert dan tegen dorpsgenoten. Want vreemden kunnen altijd teruggaan naar hun eigen huis. Maar een verstoten dorpsgenoot moet het bos in en krijgt het boze oog. Ga naar huis. Dat is het beste.
Heer Bommel gehoorzaamde spraakloos. Na veel moeite slaagde hij erin de oude schicht op gang te krijgen en toen reed hij treurig gestemd naar de horizon. In het dorp Ooikooi heeft men hem niet meer teruggezien.
Spelserie naar de verhalen van Martin Toonder, met in de hoofdrollen Mark Rietman, Jacob Derwig en Krijn ter Braak. Regie Jeroen Stout. Voor alle informatie en podcasting, hoorspelbommel.nl. Bommel wordt mede mogelijk gemaakt door het Stimuleringsfonds Nederlandse Culturele Omroepproducties en de Stichting Het Toonder Auteursrecht.
Voice you hear with every breath, and in this labyrinth, where Prince is blind. The Phantom of the Opera is here. Inside my mind,
there is no Phantom of the Opera.
Round I've been there to his world of unending night, to a world where the daylight dissolves into darkness, darkness. Round I've seen him, and I'll never forget that sight. Can I ever escape from that face? How distorted, deformed, it was hardly a face in that darkness, darkness. But his voice filled my spirit with a strange, sweet sound. In that night there was music in my mind.
Christine.
God, did I record that? Is Mary Had a Little Lamb? Is that a protest song? Treat you, simplify you, classify you, deny, defy, or crucify you. All I really wanna do is, baby, be friends with you. Fight with you, frighten you, or uptighten you, drag you down, or drain you down, or chain you down, or bring you down. All I really wanna do is, baby, be friends with you. Face you, race or chase you, track or trace you, or disgrace you, or displace you, or confine you, or define you. All I really wanna do is, baby, be friends with you. Block or shock or knock you up, analyze you, categorize you, finalize you or advertise you. All I really wanna do is, baby, be friends with you. Kin, make you spin or do you in, and it don't matter if you feel like me, see like me, or be like me. All I really wanna do is, baby, be friends with you.
Don't give me no hand-me-down love. Don't give me no hand-me-down. anacığım oldu erdi muradına.
Çalıdan biri konaklar yakıp yıkan, zulmün bileğini büken yiğitler. Çakıcalı'dan biri konaklar yakıp yıkan, zulmün bileğini büken yiğitler. Sağlığın dört bir yana, dağlar ona kucak açtı. Yoldaşları silah çattı. Kurtuluşa dağlar ona kucak açtı. Yoldaşları silah çattı. Kurtuluşa bir sultan soyundan akan yiğitler, Börklüce'yle cenge kalkan yiğitler. Çakırcalı'dan biri konaklar yakıp yıkan, zulmün bileğini büken yiğitler. Çakırcalı'dan biri konaklar yakıp yıkan, zulmün bileğini büken yiğitler.
We waren tot en konden ademen.
De tijd bestaat niet, maar telt toch al onze stappen. Allemaal. Naar elkaar toe, van elkaar weg.
Doe het nu.
Doe het.
de soepjurk.
Doe de soepjurk
nu. Fijn.
Daar hou ik wel van.
Maar tel de soepjurk. Doe het nu.
Harder.
Harder. Sneller.
De soepjurk. Wat een kabaal. Wat een kabalesk, grotesk, carnavalesk, kabalistisch, grabistisch, klemmikolofisch, gedreun. Wat een getrek en
wat een gesteun.
Naar elkaar toe. Doe.
Is het een maan?
Van elkaar weg.
Doe.
Of is het de witte subjurk die daarop bijtrekt?
Is het de witte subjurk?
We liepen zeven keer, zeven maanden, rond die maan.
Maar tel toch al.
Van en naar vloed tot ver weg hier vandaan.
Maantrekker, trek de maan.
De is het de zon?
Doe het nu.
Of is het dat gele laken dat je van mijn bed trekt?
Is de zon?
We zeilden al zeven keer zeven zonnewendes en nog dekt geen schaduw de twijfel.
We zeilen al zeven keer
zeven
zonnewendes en nog dekt geen schaduw de twijfel.
Doe ze soepjurk, doe ze soepjurk, doe ze soepjurk.
In zon af, doe
ze soepjurk,
doe de soepjurk. Doe het.
Doe het.
Elk
doe
het. Is wiskunde.
Spoel de soepjurk af.
Ook al voor
doe het nu. Doe het.
Doe het
soepjurk. Doe de soepjurk.
De standjurk.
Mijn hart klopt matig.
De standjurk.
Doe het.
Doe het nu.
De standjurk oplichten. De soepjurk. Doe de
soepjurk.
Ik giet je hart en lippen in je kom met ontbijt graag. Pauze.
Zeven keer zeven zonnewendes en nog dekt geen schaduw de twijfel in zon af. Doe de soepjurk, doe het, spoel de soepjurk af. Doe het nu, doe het, doe de soepjurk, doe de soepjurk nu. Fijn, daar hou ik wel van.
The omnibus edition of My Name is Why, in which Lem Sisse, the award-winning poet, reads from his frank memoir about growing up in Britain's care system in the 70s and 80s while musing on the redemptive power of poetry. Lem begins his courageous account with his early days in foster care.
At 14, I tattooed the initials of what I thought was my name into my hand. The tattoo is still there, and it wasn't my name. I was not who I thought I was. The authority knew it, but I didn't. The authority were writing reports about me from the day I was born. My first footsteps were followed by the click-clack-clack of a typewriter. Papers zipped from typewriters and into files. For 18 years, this process repeated over and over again. Click, clack, clack. The folders were taken out and placed on tables surrounded by men and women from the authority. Put him here. Move him there. Shall we try drugs? Try this? Try that? After 18 years of experimentation, the authority threw me out. It locked the doors securely behind me and hid the files in a data company called the Iron Mountain. So I wrote to the authority. Customer services replied to say they were not permitted to release the files. The authority placed me with incapable foster parents. It imprisoned me. It moved me from institution to institution. And yet now, at 18 years old, I had no history, no witnesses, no family. In 2015, following a 30-year campaign to get my records, the chief executive of Wigan Council, Donna Hall, wrote me a letter. She had them. Within a few months, I received four thick folders of documents. On reading them, I knew. I took the authority to court. Awake amongst the lost and found, the files left on the open floor, the frozen leaves on frosted ground, the frosted keys in a frozen door. 18 years of records written by strangers. All the answers to all my questions were here, possibly. And yet I feared what they'd reveal. Maybe I was loved. Maybe my mother didn't want me. Maybe it was all my fault. St. Margaret's House was an institution for unmarried mothers, affiliated to the Board of Moral Welfare. On 30th of June 1967, the state registered nurse writes that Lemmian Cisse, misspelt, was free from infectious diseases, and that the six-week-old baby weighed 9 pounds. In a letter written by Dr. Bernardo's to Norman Goldthorpe, children's officer for Wigan Authority, I'm 6 months old. At this point, my mother is invisible.
Dear Mr. Goldthorpe, further to your inquiry regarding the possibility of our adoption department being able to place a part Ethiopian, part Greek baby boy for adoption, our senior adoption officer has written to us asking that she be supplied with details of his background and whether Ethiopian means he is Negroid or not.
Then there was a photo on the back of which it says,
Norman Cisse.
So my name was changed to Norman Cisse. I'm supposed to be part Greek. An adoption agency asks whether Ethiopian means he is Negroid or not. This is the first time I have seen myself referred to as Norman Cisse. In England, unmarried pregnant women were placed in mother and baby homes like St. Margaret's. Many of them didn't understand the full implication of the word adoption. They were sent home without their newborn after signing the adoption papers. My mother would not sign the adoption papers. Without my mother's signature on the adoption papers, the authority could not adopt me. So Norman Goldthorpe defied her and assigned me to long-term foster parents, Catherine and David Greenwood. My foster parents told me some years later that I was alone in the hospital because no one would adopt a coloured baby. They said they chose me after praying to God and that my mother didn't want me. My mother must have been at her most vulnerable. She was pregnant and alone in a foreign country where she'd come to study for a short period of time. I was 3.5 years old when the authority served a notice on my mother via her church in Ethiopia to say that all rights and powers of the parent of Lem Cisse be vested in the local authority, it appearing that the parent has abandoned this child. She was given 1 month to object to the notice. The notice would have taken a month to arrive in Ethiopia and another month for the letter to return. It was an impossible deadline. My story begins without her or any knowledge of her. The Greenwoods and I lived in a semi-detached house with a solid red brick gable end wall. We attended Bryn Baptist on Wednesday and Sunday. It's where our friends and family were, and we prayed. At breakfast, at lunch, at dinner. There was good and bad in the world. There was darkness and light, black and white. On 29th of May 1968, my file reports,
Norman is a healthy, contented child. The foster parents are devoted to him. He's a very affectionate child with large, appealing eyes.
Christopher, the Greenwoods' firstborn child, my little brother, came along in July. And on 15th of October 1968, it is reported,
Norman is very good with the new baby. He has got over his initial jealousy. Mrs. Greenwood is an excellent little mother.
Sarah was born 2 years after Christopher, and 8 years later came Helen. Only 14 months apart in age, Christopher and I fought like brothers. Cats and dogs had nothing on us. I adored him. When it came to the colour of my skin, my parents referred to me as chocolate. No one told me I was the same colour as Martin Luther King or Muhammad Ali. Racist comments from the outer world became more frequent. Mum and Dad's response was to tell me to ignore it or that we are all God's children. My mum fostered a coloured baby in 1967, in a time of racial intolerance in England. Some smiled and stopped me in the pram, and others spat on the back of her coat as she walked by. Years later, they'd do the same to me. So whatever this racism was, it would be the shadow to the light of their love. I was a happy child. Mum had short black hair and dark eyes. For ages, I'd pray that she'd sit on the edge of my bed and sing me to sleep as she did when I was younger. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are grey. I believed her. Dad was broody, tall, witty and silent. The front room was his library. Cornerstone books for me were the Bible, the famous five series, and The Lion, The Witch and The Wardrobe. I don't remember other novels or poetry except T.S. Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, which was my favourite. Mum and Dad said I was like McCavity. It felt affectionate then, but later I realised something wasn't right. McCavity was dark, quick, and a thief. On 11th of December 1974, the social worker wrote,
There are no problems with Norman. Mrs. Greenwood considers him as theirs. The foster parents have spoken of adoption, but they are afraid that investigations may lead to his mother. Norman is said to be exceptionally bright. He's very aware of his colour and often asks why he could not have been born to a white lady.
I was a questioner. In the Baptist church, we were taught to question why. The answer was often, because we are sinners. At school, I was subject to all kinds of questions about my race, which I couldn't answer. I brought all these questions home. She left you. She didn't want you. If I find her, I will scratch her eyes out. My mum's love was elevated by how much she hated my birth mother for leaving me. I'm 7. This is what my social worker writes.
Mr. and Mrs. Greenwood realised that there may be many problems ahead with Norman, as well as a lot of happiness.
I developed a sense that there was something wrong with me around the time I began attending junior school. my social worker, reports.
After the school holidays, Christopher will be starting at the same school. And it will be interesting to see what happens, because Norman does not like Christopher to be better than him at anything.
None of what I've told you so far is true. I wasn't a happy child. I was a deceitful one. I was causing problems for everyone. It must be true.
January 1976. Spoke to Mr. Graves several times on the phone and eventually visited the school. He felt that Norman's successes were too many for his brother to cope with. Went on to talk about another placement. I put it to him that it was the only home the boy had known.
I was 9, my brother Christopher was 8. I showed my love for him by punching him. We fought with unbridled determination, the way brothers do, until one of us, invariably Christopher, would burst into tears. Catherine and David had no children when they took me. Christopher was their firstborn, but I was their first. I was the eldest. I loved my family. The head teacher suggesting to the social worker that I be moved for the sake of Christopher could not have happened in isolation. This inclines me to think my foster parents must have spoken to the head teacher. On 28th of July 1975, the social worker visited.
I called to see Norman today, the family having just returned from a holiday in Scotland. Mrs. Greenwood was upset. It seems that Norman had been getting up in the early hours and eating sweet foods, particularly biscuits, as many as 2 packets.
For the record, I did steal biscuits, but not 2 whole packs. One holiday in Scotland, at my granddad's home, the family left me in the cottage as punishment for lying about stealing some cake. I thought I'd been locked in my room, but the door was open. I sobbed my way downstairs. I saw on the table a half-cut ginger cake. The tears evaporated, replaced by butterflies in my stomach. If I cut it in exactly the same way as it was already cut, then nobody would notice that I had taken a slice. Genius! And so I did. It tasted so good. So I did it again. To this day, I don't know why I got into this habit of stealing biscuits and bits of cake, but I did. They told me I was devious. The problem was that my first instinct was to say, I didn't steal the cake. The lies worried them more than the theft. Stealing cake and lying about it was an indication that the devil was working inside of me. Within 3 years, it will be reported that I threatened to kill the entire family except for baby Helen. Look what was sown by the stars at night across the fields. I am not defined by scars, but by the incredible ability to heal. It was run by the elders, Bryn Baptist Church, a mile from our home, and a mile from Grandma and Grandad Munro. Church was full of horrific stories. People drowned in the huge flood, and Jesus stabbed with huge nails and hung on a wooden cross. Repent, repent for your sins. The temperature rose with the pastor's words. Mum threw up her arms, praise him. So I threw up mine. Was I saved by Jesus? I spent 12 years kneeling and praying, and it was the powerful rhetoric and lyricism of the church that took me to poetry. There is barely any mention of religion in my files. It wasn't discussed with a social worker.
The child has an extrovert personality and is attention-seeking. The foster parents' own children are somewhat overshadowed by this child.
Winnick was a sprawling red brick institution set in manicured greenery. Mum, me and Chris walked through the front door, and after Mum signed a register, we stepped into the wide, tiled corridor of the asylum. Our footsteps led to a big public room with lots of winged armchairs with women in them. Mum spotted one of them and stepped quietly over to her. She had an overhang to her mouth, wolf-like, hair like a nest, and she was rocking backwards and forwards. "Say hello to your auntie." "Hello, auntie." A twisted elbow pushed out a clawed hand towards me and brushed my cheek. She couldn't speak. Mum took out a hanky and lovingly wiped drool from auntie's mouth and chin, and I knew instinctively not to ask questions. Mum visited her twin regularly, sometimes alone, sometimes with us. My auntie had been like that from birth. My grandmother never visited her daughter with my mum and us. Did my mum blame herself? Was Catherine living with a constant sense that she was not good enough because she had taken the heir from her twin sister? She would do everything to prove otherwise. She would foster a black baby and show her mother that she was good. I saw Grandma at least once a week and I loved her. Maybe she did love Catherine, the twin that survived. But Catherine never felt it and subsequently found love difficult to give. Mum was a state-registered nurse. At the hint of a scratch or bump, she'd draw the medical kit from the top of the kitchen cabinet. I'm not sure I ever felt as close to her than when she'd say, "This is going to hurt," before dabbing my grey's knee with a pinch of cotton wool soaked in witch hazel. It's because she was a nurse that she had the comb. Each morning before school, I'd stand by the heater in the kitchen, and Mum dragged the comb through the roots until my skull felt like it had been dipped in acid. "You have hair sore," she'd say. Apparently, hair sore was a medical condition. Then, on a spring day, Mum got me up in my best shirt and trousers. I was going to meet a pop star. Errol Brown was the lead singer for Hot Chocolate. Mum took me to an apartment in Winstanley. I remember there were bowls of nuts and crisps, and it wasn't even Christmas. Errol Brown chatted to me about school. He was black, like me. I was nervous and intrigued all at the same time, and then he left the room and came back with a present for me. I stared at the strange and elegant genius of design, an afro comb. He'd been visiting a newborn child of a family friend at the hospital. Mum was the midwife on call, and they must have got talking about me. Maybe she showed him the thin-toothed comb she'd been using. Maybe he winced and gritted his teeth to stop him saying, "His hair is Ethiopian hair. Why did you not get this boy an afro comb?" On 19th of April 1978, the social worker writes,
"There is a letter on file from Norman's mother, written in 1968, requesting that he be returned to her in Ethiopia. Perhaps Norman should be made aware of this."
And underneath, a handwritten comment,
"Not yet, I think."
The social worker's report continues,
"The Greenwoods are seen by Norman as his parents."
Why would the social worker say that? They told me they were my parents forever. Why would I think anything else? As with most brothers close in age, Christopher and I fought like snakes on each other's territory. Christopher always, even in the midst of thrills, betrayed a fretfulness. I had no idea that Mum thought it was my fault. We raced each other home from school every single day, and every single day I beat him. I waited in the kitchen by my mum. He dived into Mum's arms and said, "Mum, Mum, I beat Norman, didn't I?" She stroked his head, and then she looked at me.
"Yes, you did."
1973. I've only two school reports from my infants and junior schools.
"Norman is a carefree and happy child and is an asset to the class. His lively personality makes him popular with the other children."
11th of July, 1978. My junior school report. I am 11 years old.
"Norman is an enthusiastic worker. He is cooperative and eager to please. Norman is a most likeable boy." A ray of sunshine.
12th of July, 1978, the social worker's response.
Discussed Norman with Miss Jones, who has a quite pathetic attitude towards the child, purely based on his colour. See recent report where she refers to him as ray of sunshine. Hopefully the staff at his new school will be more realistic.
December 1978, the social worker reports that Mrs. Greenwood had a daughter. Her name was Helen. It was an unexpected pregnancy. The household now had 4 children and 2 adults. The social worker received a phone call on 13th of May 1979, 8 days before my 12th birthday.
Phone call from Mrs. Greenwood. A row with Norman had resulted in him threatening to kill all members of the family, except baby Helen. Mrs. Greenwood had reacted by packing him off to her mother's visit, and Mrs. Greenwood very upset. The row had developed from Norman badgering Chris to loan him his cricket stumps. Mrs. Greenwood had advised Chris not to loan them, as Norman is extremely careless with equipment. Norman had told Chris that the decision was his and not their mum's. Mrs. Greenwood lost her temper and told him to leave.
Home was hell. I couldn't do anything right. The better I did, the worse I was treated. I was deceitful. I was tricking everyone into thinking I was a good kid. For the life of me, I didn't understand. On 16th of June 1979, a visit from the social worker.
Some 10 minutes with Norman on his own. The incident had clearly shaken Norman. He admitted to difficulties of controlling his temper, but insisted that he had not meant what he said. He did recognise that his mum was under strain, although he didn't know why, told him some of the reasons, and his response was, "If only I had realised."
I didn't threaten to murder the family. Full disclosure, I probably said to my brother, "I'm going to kill you." Brothers say things like that in the heat of the moment. The following report by my new social worker is from 2nd of November 1979.
Mrs. Greenwood told me that they had been to a parents' evening at school last night and that there had been very unfavourable reports about Norman. She says that she sometimes thinks Norman is amoral. She told me that he smokes, swears, steals, and he seems to harbour a grudge about being black. She said that she was at the end of her tether.
The only report from my high school is from the summer of 1979.
Well behaved in lessons. Always keen to please and has many friends. Norman has settled down well in his first year.
I felt like I'd done everything to show them that I love them. And I'd done everything to show God that I loved God. And they were still my parents forever. Right? On 1st of December 1979, the report records that Mrs. Greenwood called the social worker to take me away. He writes,
"Spoke to foster parents on telephone. Both almost insisted that Norman had to leave today. I explained that we should discuss this. Arranged to see them on the 2nd of January 1980 with a provisional place in Woodfield arranged."
Norman Mills, my social worker, has since told me that he informed the foster parents that having made a commitment to me as their parents, it was not right for them to demand I be taken away. So I didn't go. It was the end of December 1979, when I was excited when I entered the front room for the family meeting, because it was just me and Mum and Dad. I sat at the table, and my mum looked at me intensely. "You don't love us, do you?" I said, "Yes, I do love you. We want you to spend the next day thinking about love and what it is. Read the scriptures and give us your most honest and truthful answer tomorrow." That was it. It was a clear instruction from Mum and Dad. I prayed to God and I read the Bible to see if a passage would answer the question. They wanted me to ask God for forgiveness and through him I would learn to love them. And in the Baptist faith, a sinner must ask forgiveness for his sins. The theology was perfect, the timing unquestionable, and the answer as honest as a sinner could get. The next day came, and I said it with pride, because I thought I had found the answer that they wanted. "I mustn't love you," I said. I looked at their faces to see if I had said the right thing. "But I will ask God for forgiveness, and I'll learn to love you." This was the perfect answer. See?